And so what we see, what I would like to pose as a challenge is that we work towards a reformulation of human rights claims from one of individual entitlements to one of institutional responsibilities. And yet we also have to face political reality. The contemporary political context is one where we cannot avoid the fact that human rights now, notions of human rights, are used to justify wars or what are called humanitarian wars or what are called wars of liberation or wars of bringing democracy to Iraq and other places. We also cannot avoid the fact that some key intellectuals who have been extremely important in terms of promoting notions of human rights are in fact promoting notions like torture light. And I'm thinking, for example, of Michael Ignatieff, who's been a major force, intellectual force, in terms of promoting an understanding of human rights. And yet he's now in a position where he's publicly saying that torture in some circumstances and under very specific, in very specific contexts is okay. Now, that those kind of claims, in a way, diminish the power of human rights arguments, and yet at the same time, they challenge those who claim a human rights discourse to reclaim that discourse, and in fact to do so in a way that is significant in terms of practical day-to-day problems. And so we also can't avoid the fact that we also can't avoid the fact that the context where rules are made and then ignored is one that exists largely through the actions of the strong. And I'm thinking, for example, of the creation of the WTO itself. The WTO was created largely by the trade interests of Western business, which lobbied Western governments to create an institution that would codify a global free trade regime. Part of that was the TRIPS agreement, or the Trade Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. That agreement, and there's not much contestation around this, that agreement was largely written by the pharmaceutical industry and then promoted and brought into law through the lobbying efforts of the American government. And then we also see that even with a free trade agreement, a global free trade agreement, bilateral pressures and trade sanctions and so on are still brought to bear by the Americans and also largely by the EU when specific trade issues are not in the interests of their corporate constituencies. And these are the political realities that we have to deal with, or that we have to face in terms of trying to advance the notions that that we're talking about. So let me just conclude by saying that we have seen significant changes at the WHO, for example. We've seen the creation of a new institution, the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria. We've also seen significant political declarations at the WTO. And in my view, these kinds of changes can be advanced using a human rights discourse that demands institutional responsibility in the realization of human rights. And that is a core challenge. And we can do, the point of doing this is to create at a global institutional level a counterweight, if you will, to the power of an organization like the WTO, which is the most powerful institution, a global institution in the world, simply because it is the only global institution in the world that has an enforcement mechanism and an enforcement capacity, and a capacity to actually impose enforcement decisions. In pursuing this kind of approach to human rights, it can redefine a new normative structure to rein in, if you will, the negative effects of bilateral trade agreements and regional and growing now growing regional trading blocs. And I think if you look at the actual charter itself, the UN Charter, the UN Declaration on Human Rights, there is an article that deals specifically with the issue that I'm trying to put forward here. And that's Article 28 of the Declaration. And the article says, everyone, and this is actually in the Charter, or in the Declaration, everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this Declaration can be fully realized. And this, in practical terms, is what activists have been doing over the last 7 years. And what I would like to see happen over the course of our deliberations, not only tonight but also over the weekend, is an active engagement of some of the concepts that, for example, Thomas Pogge will present in a few minutes, that are extremely compelling ideas and extremely compelling arguments as to why and how moral claims on institutions around the realization of human rights can actually be made. Thank you.
Our next speaker, this is, I'm going to be brief so as not to interrupt the flow of the conversation because I think it's very complimentary. It's a great moment. So Dr. Carlos Correa is trained in economics and law at the University of Buenos Aires, from which he also obtained his doctorate. And since then, he has pursued a career in academia and in consultancy with activities for a time in government. From 1984 to 89, he was the Undersecretary of State for Informatics and Development in the Argentine National Government. During this period, he was coordinator of the Interministerial Group on Intellectual Property. From 1988 to 1991, he was the government delegate in international negotiations on intellectual property, including the Washington Treaty on Integrated Circuits and the TRIPS Agreement. He also participated as FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, consultant in the negotiation of the FAO International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources. He's been a consultant to various international organizations, to regional organizations, and also to the governments of many countries, including our own, Spain, Ecuador, Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, Uruguay, Jordan, South Africa, and Indonesia, and also has served as a consultant to the Rockefeller Foundation and DFID in the United Kingdom. He was a member of the UK International Commission on Intellectual Property, established in 2001. In 1999, he was a finalist of the World Technology Award for Policy Competition of The Economist for contributions made in the area of intellectual property, particularly in the field of biotechnology in developing countries. And in January 2004, he was appointed by the Director General of the World Health Organization as a member of the Commission on Intellectual Property Rights, Innovation, and Public Health. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you very much, Mira, for this long presentation. I'm very thankful for the invitation to participate in this conference. When Mira invited me, she told me that I would have 5 minutes to talk. Can you imagine a Latin American talking for just 5 minutes? Well, unfortunately, she changed the rules, and I will be allowed to talk a little more than 5 minutes. I hope you will not complain about this. I will address one specific issue, and this is the relationship between intellectual property, and in particular patents, with access to drugs and the realization of the human right to health. So this will be the focus of my short presentation. As you may know, before the TRIPS Agreement, which is an agreement within the World Trade Organization, was adopted in 1994, all countries have a number of flexibilities in order to devise their own patent systems. They could, for instance, allow or not the patentability of pharmaceutical products. And in fact, many developing countries and also a number of developed countries did not grant patents on pharmaceutical products until they were forced under the TRIPS agreement. This meant that in these countries there was competition. It was possible to have pharmaceutical products from different sources and not only from the patent owner, and this led to significant prices, lowering prices in these countries. Of course, this has changed drastically after the TRIPS agreement was adopted. This agreement has imposed on all countries which are members to the World Trade Organization the obligation to recognize patents in all fields of technology, including certainly the area of pharmaceuticals. So since the adoption of this agreement, this flexibility that was available to developing countries does not exist anymore, And we have now a situation in which all countries must accept the rules of patents in this area. The question I will address is what is the role of patents, in particular in the area of pharmaceuticals, in developing countries? Are they good? Are they bad? This is not the kind of questions, simple questions we are going to address. We are trying to explore what consequences patenting has in developing countries, in particular to in relation to access to drugs. The standard theory about patents and in general intellectual property argues that the exclusive rights that are granted to the patent owners and other IP owners are justified in the following terms. It is said that the sacrifice of the so-called static efficiency, the fact that the patent owner can charge prices higher than those that would prevail in case of free competition or existence of competition, is justified because of the gains that will be obtained in what is called dynamic efficiency. This is the fact that the static efficiency losses may generate new products, innovations in the future, and therefore this would be a justification for the losses that the society is prepared to face today. This means in practical terms that the patent owner or the owner of intellectual property rights can charge prices which are higher than the marginal cost, can charge monopolistic prices, what the market bears. And the theory argues that with these additional profits that the patent owner or others can get, this money can be put back into research and development, and this research and development will generate future products that will benefit the society as a whole. So this is essentially a theory according to which it is good for society to have a loss today in order to get some advantages tomorrow on the basis of innovation. So the question is, does the theory work in a developing countries context? Can we assume that we are in a situation where this theory will actually operate? I think that the reply to this question is that this is not the case. Please consider that in the case of developing countries, 80% of the cost of medicines is paid out of the pocket of patients. This is very different from the case in developed countries, in which about around the same proportion is covered by security systems or by the governments. This is not happening in developing countries. In a developing country, in the majority of situations, either you have money to pay your medicine or you cannot get it. So in this situation, the fact that it is possible to charge high prices, which are very much higher than the marginal cost for production of a drug, means that many people cannot get the treatment that they need. And this is a major difference with a situation in developed country. In a developed country, it might be the society may be prepared to pay a higher price, because the assumption is that in any case there will be access to the product, so you will sacrifice other consumption. In a developing country, the situation is one in which there will be no possibility of paying a higher price, and therefore the consequence is that there is deprivation of the treatment to the people. And this is one of the reasons that explain the figures that we have seen a few minutes before, indicating that very simple medicines could be provided in order to save lives in developing countries. But when you have people that live out of $1 or $2 a day, there is a situation in which this is impossible. So this means that the assumption that is in the foundation of the patent theory and the intellectual property theory in a developed country context does not operate in a situation as we have in developing countries. A second assumption of the theory is that the money that is obtained through extra profits by companies that, that hold patents and other intellectual property rights is put back into research and development that will produce new treatments, that will produce new therapeutic improvements. And this is also questionable, at least in two respects. On the one hand, we are witnessing a situation in which, despite the increased investment in research and development, there is a very significant decline in innovation in the pharmaceutical industry. In particular, if you measure innovation in the pharmaceutical industry on the basis of what are called new chemical entities, that is new molecules. The fact is that 10 years ago, for instance, there were about 90 new chemical entities per year that were discovered and subject to process of approval in FDA and other countries. And during the last years, we have an average of around 20 new chemical entities per year. And in addition to this, there is a trend which is quite clear today, and this is the fact that the new chemical entities that are developed, in most cases, do not provide new therapeutic progress or contributions. These are the so-called me-toos. These are new molecules that treat diseases that are already under treatment with perhaps some improvement, but do not provide a significant advance from a therapeutic point of view. Moreover, it is interesting to see that although the number of new chemical entities is declining substantially, as I have mentioned, the number of patents in pharmaceuticals that are applied for and granted every year is not declining, it's increasing. There are thousands of patents which are applied for and granted every year. How can we explain this paradox? The reason is that despite this declining trend in innovation, pharmaceutical companies use the patent system in order to get protection for minor innovations, very trivial developments, which are used once protection is given in order to block competition. This is very well known in the case of Canada. This is known as the evergreening patents. This is the fact that although the original patents on active ingredients have expired or are about to expire, a new set of patents are applied for and in many cases obtained on minor modifications that prevent generic competition or delay significantly generic competition in some cases for many years. So therefore, we have a situation in which patents are promoting innovation, but are not promoting the innovation of the kind that the public health is asking for, is needing. And the second aspect of the incentive that patents grant in the area of research and development in pharmaceuticals is that companies that get this extra profit through patents invest in research and development which is profitable. They do not invest in research and development for diseases that prevail in poor countries or that prevail among poor people. So there is a very strong association between the patent system and the market size. The patent system does not provide any incentive to research and develop in the areas where there is no profitable market. And this is the reason why, as it is mentioned in many publications, MSF has extensively worked on this, and James has mentioned this. This is why there is a large number of diseases that prevail in developing countries, such as malaria or Chagas in Latin America, for instance, or even tuberculosis, on which very little investment is done by those who own and exploit and benefit from the patent system. And this is why some other solutions are needed in order to address the very important problems that are faced in the area of these diseases. So this means that although developing countries have been forced to accept patentability in their pharmaceuticals and except for the very, very poor, least developed countries, they are all complying with this rule, they are not getting any benefit in terms of research and development done in order to address the problems that prevailed in those countries. A second issue I would like to address is the cost and benefit of a patent system in a North-South perspective. Consider that developing countries as a whole account for only 10% of the world pharmaceutical market in value. So this means that most sales in pharmaceuticals are done in developed countries, and developing countries still have a very small share of the whole pharmaceutical sales in the world. What does it mean in terms of cost and benefits for, of the patent system? This means that, in fact, the profits that the companies are making mainly come from developed countries. And they are also, as I mentioned, making profits in developing countries. But the point is that the benefits that the pharmaceutical company gets in developing countries in many cases is insignificant in terms of their overall budgets. Let me give you an example, the case of Guatemala, for instance. Guatemala has been under strong pressure during the last years in order to significantly increase protection for patents and also another area which is called data exclusivity. Guatemala is a country where you have more than 60% of poor people. Guatemala is a very small market in terms of sales for any pharmaceutical company. Despite this, this country, and as well as other Central American countries which share the same situation, have been under strong pressure by the USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative of the United States, and by pharmaceutical companies in order to give more protection to pharmaceutical developments, both in terms of patents and in terms of clinical data. Is there any justification for this in terms of the profits and benefits that the companies may get? Certainly it is not. Whatever they can get from Guatemala and Central American countries has not changed at all the possibilities of these companies to undertake research and development, which in the end, as I mentioned, it is done in order to produce products which are addressed to the rich markets and not to the markets of developing countries. Professor Scherer from Harvard University took a number of years in order to make a study about the implications of the extension of patent protection all over the world, and in particular to developing countries. And the question Professor Scherer did was whether there was a reason in order to extend patent protection into developing countries from the point of view of additional funds for research and development, which is the typical argument which is used in this area. And Professor Scherer found that there was no reason for that. He found that the additional funds that companies could get from developing countries through the patent system, it is insignificant in terms of increasing the research and development they can do or increasing the number of molecules that the companies can develop. And why am I'm arguing along these lines? I'm doing this because I want you to compare the benefits that can accrue to the companies from developing countries and the cost that the application of the system entails for these countries. And here there is a major disproportion. Because while the benefits, if I'm correct, are not so huge because of the low weight of the markets of developing countries for the whole industry, the cost that people in developing countries has to face because of the extension of the system are enormous. They are enormous because this means that a product may cost three or four times, or perhaps more, than the cost that would exist in the absence of protection. So this means that, as it is evident in the case of Central American countries or other countries, There is no proportionality between the gains that are obtained by the companies that so strongly seek for patent protection and data protection these days, and the cost that the people suffer in the countries where a large part of the population is poor. So I think we need to address this major asymmetry, and there are some measures that countries may adopt, and James has mentioned some of them. The Doha Declaration that was adopted by the World Trade Organization confirms the possibility of countries of using compulsory licensing, which is an authorization given by the state in order to use an invention, even if patented, flexibilities in order to allow for parallel imports and others, another type of flexibilities. The problem is that developing countries have faced, as it was mentioned, strong pressure by developed countries, in particular the United States, and the strong lobbies from the industry in order not to use the flexibilities. That means in order to respect, as it is said, intellectual property rights without any limitation. And in addition, as James has also mentioned, there is a recent trend which is promoted very actively by the United States in order to get increased protection through bilateral agreements or free trade agreements. These agreements, some examples are those established with Chile, Morocco, Bahrain. There are now negotiations going on with Andean countries and Jordan and some other countries. Include chapters on intellectual property in which developing countries, which are partners to these agreements, are obliged to give up the flexibilities that I have mentioned before to a great extent, and therefore the level of protection is increased. Just to give you an example, patents must last, according to the international rules, for 20 years, counted from the date of application. 20 years is quite a long term. Under these FTA agreements, this term is extended in order to compensate the so-called delays in the approval of the medicines or in the examination of the patents. So patents may last not for 20 years, but maybe for 25 or for 28 years. And this means that competition is delayed and high prices will prevail during that period. So, just to finish, what conclusions can we draw from this very brief analysis? The first one is that patents can certainly be an important incentive for research and development. And this I think we cannot question. To the extent that the patents offer a monopolistic position, those who have the capacity to make research and development see this as a great opportunity in order to charge high prices and get significant returns. The problem, however, is that this incentive does not work in the same way in different contexts. It does not work in the same way in developed countries and it doesn't and in developing countries. In the case of the latter, the incentive does not operate, and moreover, the patents do not provide, as I mentioned, any incentive in order to work for the diseases that prevail in those countries. A second conclusion is that if we could develop a rational approach to patents and intellectual property in the world, we should certainly opt for a system that recognizes the difference of level of development among countries.